Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, Sangha discussion on the Four Noble Truths, and Dhamma talk that introduces the fourth week study of Right View and Right Intention, the Wisdom Factors of the Eightfold Path. This was recorded on December 27, 2016 at Crossover Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So we actually have four new members tonight. I didn't welcome Paul. Paul, welcome to our Sangha. I'm sorry I forgot you before. That's Paul in the back. And Toph is in again from Seattle. It's a rough ride every week, isn't it?
His motorbike.
I'm glad you're still here. So we will, I'll check on your homework. We'll discuss the Four Noble Truths, and then I'll introduce this week's study on right view and right intention. Matt, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Good to be here with everybody. The Four Noble Truths chapter is one that I think I have to keep coming back to that more than anything else. Like the Eightfold Path, I can remember each one, and I can think about them in relation to certain events in my life. But then I remember that those are all in the context of the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
So I think that really pithy four little truths are what this is all about. So it just stands to come back to those.
Yeah. That's the right word, pithy. I like that word, as opposed to concise. But everything that the Buddha would teach for the 45 years of his teaching career was in the context of the Four Noble Truths. He never taught anything extra or to develop a different understanding. He repeatedly said throughout his teaching career that I teach the understanding of suffering and the cessation of suffering, nothing more. But when you really look at that, that is the common human problem. It's what we're all after. We're all after a way of developing a type of peace and happiness that we can depend on and we know is going to be there. And that's the underlying message of the Four Noble Truths. And I should say for our newcomers, we're in the third week of a study of my book called The Truth of Happiness that I mentioned before that develops meditation within this broader framework that the Buddha taught meditation in. And it covers, it really covers the entire Buddhist teaching. It doesn't cover every sutta that's in there, but that's the point of the book. And that's what we're talking. We're in the third week now. So, Laura, how's your study going?
My study is going along, and I continually remember the Four Noble Truths, especially the first one, on a regular daily basis.
Yeah.
It's very helpful, keeping my head about me.
Yeah.
When things don't go as I hope or expect. So, yeah. So I actually didn't read the chapter because I haven't been coming to class that often, but it is always a daily remembrance for me.
Yeah. And you're skillfully honest, too. Good for you. Well, I almost repeat what I just said. That Matt, the Eightfold Path develops that understanding of suffering, and the Eightfold Path is the fourth factor, or the fourth noble truth, the path leading to that understanding. So again, everything the Buddha taught was to develop an understanding of the underlying disappointing nature of life and our contribution to to that process. Luke, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you. Doing well. Yeah, I think I definitely got like some quick momentum from like the meditation and that effect of like in my life, like instantaneous like gratification, I guess, for what I was after. But this sort of practical application to your life of these, excuse me, of these four noble truths, I can see that that's going to take a little more practice with me.
Yeah, and it also points to the fact that meditation is not. In some subtle ways, we can, in a general way, look at meditation kind of as an escape, And that's okay. I mean, it's okay to every now and then just sit quietly, be mindful of your breath just to get away from life. But it's really much more than that. The purpose of meditation is to deepen our concentration so that we can hold in mind the other factors of the Eightfold Path. And so there's more to it than just that. But the profound nature of simply sitting quietly and not getting caught up in our thoughts is really the first step of interrupting our own conditioned thinking and our own real resistance to developing a true understanding of who we are in relation to the world. Glad you're here tonight. Ram, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Yeah,
how's your study?
Study's been good. And Christmas was a wonderful reminder of the first and second rule of the
tree. Dukkha occurs.
Dukkha occurs. Whoa. So it was really good to again be reminded that it's there, and it's the clinging and craving for things that keeps it going.
Yeah.
So we're working on number three.
Yeah, as we all are.
And that went relatively well, I have to say. It's to not crave for things, you know, when all the drama happens, to be able to not crave for peace and quiet, please. And it's moving along.
Yeah. Thank you. That's
enjoying going through all the steps again. Yeah, this time.
Yeah, in a structured way. That insight that it requires continued craving and clinging to continue the unsatisfactory experience that's represented as dukkha. It's up to us. You know, it takes a concerted effort, even though it's so familiar and conditioned that we don't recognize the effort we're putting into maintaining this self-referential ego personality that's prone to confusion and delusion.
It's easy to see it in other people.
Yeah. And it's easy to point it out in other people.
But it's to see your own contribution to recognizing that you're going through your own suffering still, even though you're seeing other people going through their suffering. You know, there's my own contribution to... I'm craving for something here.
Yeah, it was just a little piece.
Yeah, just a little piece.
Who was it that was talking about Alistair? I think it was Saturday's class about that the old original Christmas carol with Alistair Sim, and how probably most of you won't remember that anyway, but I do. And how he had his revelation and he's dancing around in the movie. Nobody remembers this. And basically, what he did is he waked up. He wakened up. He had achieved awakening. He put aside all his self-referential and clinging views to how Christmas should be, mean and miserly, and he ended up enjoying the last 30 minutes of December 25th. Once we develop that, it lasts for a little bit longer than a few minutes, though. So. Thank you for bringing it up. Terry, welcome to our Sangha. I know you're not doing the study with us, but hopefully you'll join us and continue. But how was your meditation tonight?
I thought it would be very difficult, 20 minutes. I'm used to a little meditation through the practice of yoga, but not 20 minutes. So I found I was able to pay attention to my breathing and stay focused.
Outstanding. And that's the basic meditation practice, recognizing you're caught up in your thoughts, come back to the sensation of breathing. And I say that because it's easy to get fixated or expect to be mindful of our breath, and if we can't do that, to get very frustrated. But nobody can do that. It really is both of those components. And if you remember that meditation is primarily for deepening concentration, and you do that method, every meditation session is successful. So I'm glad you joined us. And also to emphasize that it's more than meditation. The practice is supported by the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path, and that takes a little bit of time to develop. So. And also, if you're starting out again or just reinvigorating a practice, it really is best to start with shorter periods of meditation, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes that you can do consistently. And if you can do that twice a day, very quickly, you'll have a well-established meditation practice. And I hope you can continue to join us. So welcome. Patrick, how about you? How was your meditation tonight?
It was wonderful.
And you're able to maintain that method?
I was.
Yeah. Is this similar or maybe exactly the same of what you've been doing?
I've been practicing TM.
Oh, okay. I started out with that many, 1981 or two or something like that. And that served me well for a couple of years. And for me, it got to the point where it felt like there needed to be more to this. And back then, I think today, the politics of going into the advanced levels were a little expensive.
Yeah.
And eventually, I studied all different practices in all the different Buddhist schools, and eventually came back to this simple practice that the Buddha taught, and I found it most effective, especially the developing the broader framework. So again, welcome to our sangha, and I hope you continue to join us.
Thank you.
Do I? You look familiar to me, do I?
We've met before.
Oh, cool.
I live in Los Angeles now, so I'm visiting.
Ah, well, you're going to have a long trip. Or maybe you can hook up with Toph when you come back on Tuesday night. So, welcome to our sangha. Mary, it's good to see you tonight. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be here. I figured if you were willing to invest in the time to be here during this week, that I would too. So I'm really happy to be here.
Glad you're here.
Just had a wonderful couple of days of holiday with many, many people. And interesting when... I really didn't feel any suffering, considering I was with about 35 people that make up my intimate little family.
Yeah.
So it was really, from born 4 weeks ago to my mother, who's 85, so it was quite a variety of people from a lot of different places. So it was really very joyous, and I feel very blessed about that. That was great. Something Laura said is, one thing I do think about as I go through my practice is I really wrestle with expectations. I think it's very hard to be a mom and not, like I think I read that somewhere in the card I got when I became a mom, that I'm there to set up all the standards and expectations. Now you're telling me that's not right. So, but also even in my marriage and certainly going around holidays, you can have a lot of expectations.
Yeah.
For, one of my daughters came out of her bedroom as we went to Christmas Eve Mass, and I didn't keep it all together. it wasn't my expectation for what she should have been wearing versus what she was wearing. And it just creates this, and she could care less what my expectations are, so she makes it funny. But that's an area that I continue to think about. I'm sure it has bigger impacts than just that, and probably shows up on my face and all of that. But otherwise, my practice has really helped me to transition well from what's been a very busy year of work, and to be able to take this week off. That's not always easy for me, and the practice has really just anchored me, made me able to make that transition, and so it's been just a wonderful series of days, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Isn't it wonderful to have the framework of the Dhamma to experience our life from?
Mm-hmm.
And the there's nothing in the Dhamma that says we shouldn't have expectations, just to recognize the dukkha that arises from them. And you're doing it, But really, I'm serious about that. That's simply part of the First Noble Truth. Dukkha will occur.
Well, that is helpful, the way you just said that. It is very helpful because I do struggle with that. Even when we were on retreat, we were up talking one night, and I was like, what's up with that? We're not supposed to have expectations. So I have some work to do in that space, but I appreciate what you just said. That was generous, that, of course, we have expectations. It's the dukkha we put on top of it.
Yeah.
If they're missed expectations, yeah.
That's right. Glad you're here. Keith, good to see you tonight.
Great to see you. My practice is going very well. My study is not. I've been through this before, and the first time I went through this class, I thought I aced it. This time, not so much. It's every chapter, it's like I'm reading it again for the first time and picking up things that I must have just glossed over. There's really a lot in there. But I have a question. this chapter points out several times that we are not our personality. Why?
Like I don't know.
These are personality not our personality.
I just wrote it. I'm trying to explain it.
Maybe I'm reading it wrong.
Referring to anatta, or the not-self characteristic. When the Buddha used the word anatta, another word that's widely misunderstood to imply that there's no such thing as a self, that's not how the Buddha used the word anatta. He simply meant that word to show that what we think of ourselves is not a substantial self or a permanent self worth defending.
Okay.
So that idea that we're not our personality is simply to recognize that we've created this ego personality, which is really the veil that's obscuring reality from ourselves. It's what we use to keep ourselves separate from the truth of reality, where in this context tonight, from the Four Noble Truths, from recognizing our contribution to dukkha, to ongoing stress. So what that means is that even though we've created a strong identity of this personality does not constitute a self. It's not a self. And the reason why that's important is because with a conditioned mind, all that we think we are is this personality that we've created. And that goes back to the eye-making. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in tonight's talk, too. But
okay.
Does that answer your question, at least on a...
Sure.
Yeah. We're not what we think we are, is really what it comes down to. Until we are what we think we are. But that takes the Eightfold Path.
That just cleared it up.
You're welcome. Diane, how are you tonight? It's good to see you.
Oh, thank you for sitting up there every week. I appreciate that so much.
I got to be in front of the camera, or else I sit.
Oh, is that what? Never mind.
Yes.
I've actually been doing my homework, my practice is going well, but I don't know whether anyone ever charts their practice or anything, but mine has valleys and hills and ups and downs and stuff, and I seem to be on a kind of a really, really rocky, sandy, dry, flat, awful place, and it's okay, which is the weird part of it, and I think that I... probably am the worst practitioner there ever was because of, I feel like all this stuff is, cleaning me out. And sometimes I wonder, is there going to be anything left? And then I think of metta. And I think that's one of the gifts of the practice, is to continue to accept loving kindness for myself, the not self that I am. And the more I do that, it really kind of just trickles and flows out into my life, because it's like I can see that other people are struggling. Mm-hmm. And it's so much easier to love other people and accept them the way they are when you've been on these rocky, hilly, awful terrain within yourself. You know that it's okay for them to be there too, or wherever they are, and it's funny how it just kind of expands everything, and embraces. See, I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm really glad to be here and have this practice.
I'm glad you're here too, and you're explaining it perfectly well. The true compassion is imbued and informed by the wisdom of understanding our own suffering. It's really the only way we can understand other people's suffering. You know? And that's the true ideal of this practice, too. So I'm glad you're here, and thank you for what you said. And something that Keith said, it's almost a struggle going through it a second time. The reason why is you now have developed a framework for seeing things clearly. And that can be unsettling at first. But again, we keep coming back to this. And like I said before, everything the Buddha taught, it said that he gave over 84,000 teachings, and that number is just a number that means a lot. It means we don't know how much, but it just means he gave a lot of teachings. And every one of his discourses was in the context of the Four Noble Truths. But unless you have that, unless you have the framework and understand that, it's hard to apply some of the teachings. Some of the discourses sound ridiculous unless you understand the context and what they're presented in. And even just reading the Four Noble Truths without the other supportive context is almost like, well, so what? You know, who cares? Who cares if they're true or not? How do I apply it? Well, you don't understand it until you actually do it. So, glad you're here, Diane. Thank you. Mark, how are you tonight? Good to see you.
Good to be here. Practice is going well. I found more recently that I'm, I guess, able to see things a little bit more clearly, which is nice. And what's come with that is greater acceptance of what's actually occurring in the moment. I've noticed myself have a level of frustration reduction, I'll say, where I can see myself starting to have emotions come up, which are tied to thoughts, and instead of reacting to it, I've actually been able to just sit with the feeling and just experience it and not have to try to change it or attach anything to it. And I had a really interesting moment with that probably 4 or 5 days ago where I was really frustrated, but I didn't do anything more with it. I just sat there in the frustration, and it was pretty incredible, but I sat there for about 2 or 3 minutes without reacting, and then all of a sudden had some insight into what I was frustrated about, and then was able to really approach the situation a lot more clearly. So that's been a really good part of my practice more recently, is to just be able to see that more clearly. I feel like for a while I've been aware of it logically, but now putting it into practice has actually been pretty incredible.
Yeah. It is incredible, you know, to have, and that's that refined mindfulness. We're gaining the ability to see things clearly. Again, it's part of the talk tonight too. But thank you for sharing that, Morris. Good to see you.
Good to be here. Good to be here.
I know you just did your homework just a moment ago.
Yeah, actually, I did the wrong homework, so that's right. I was out of intention, but I knew it was. To me, it becomes difficult to sometimes pull everything apart. Like, I can tell you intellectually how it's pulled apart, but how it works in practice becomes kind of less clear sometimes. One thing that I'm just saying, like with what Mark had just said, Diane and I were talking about this yesterday, and like when I have a strong emotion or I can feel dukkha, so First Noble Truth arising, right? there's a sense of agitation or tightness or dissatisfaction. Say, and it's unpleasant. There's an aversion. Because I would say that I'm acutely aware of my cravings as well for to keep satisfaction going. So when I hear people saying like, oh, well, it was pleasant, so there was no dukkha. Well, there's a lot of clinging and craving in that pleasantness, too, if you really start to look at it. So it's kind of, that's for personal truth, right? And I was kind of looking, this is just occurring all the stinking time, you know, and it's annoying. And, but recognizing that, it's just like, oh, okay, this is just what's going on. And watching where the root of that is. and letting go of that and returning back to just the actual experience, Third Noble Truth, has been really beautiful. And then working with the view of that there is some wisdom occurring here, right? There is this process unfolding, and I do have, this being does have control over how to change that, right? It's like the impermanence of, we have the potential to recognize it and do something different. So there was this discussion of this personality, I think Keith brought it up, and what I'm starting to notice is I'm more identified with my intentions than I am with who I am. Like, that's become something that I'm really working, like, applying a lot of effort to watching clinging and craving as it's arising, reminding myself, this is what you're doing. You're being kind to yourself. The best thing you can do is let go of it. In meditation, in life, like, and it's joyful, finally. It's very motivating and inspiring and energizing to have that clarity and to kind of watch it. And I'm very interested in meditation, of just really being very kind and loving towards when I see you're in thought and you see it and come back. And, you know, so it becomes this, that's what's moving forward, whatever that is, whether it's a personality or, it's not a personality, that's a, it's an unfolding emergent property of awakening mind or something, maybe. I don't know what it is, but it's like, that's interesting. And in the frustrations of turning towards it and being with it and being curious and saying, what is it that I can't be with? What am I so averse to right now? Oh, it's feeling like you've disappointed somebody or somebody's annoyed, you know? So, and then it's like, okay, all right. Big deal. You know, like, once you can be with it, you don't, it doesn't hold a lot of power over you anymore. Oh, and the last thing I would say is, so it's been interesting because Liz is talking about expectations, and I had my whole family over for Christmas Eve, and in the past I've gotten all hung up in about people think I'm going to do it right, I want to make them happy, and I kept thinking, what will make things better is if I'm calm and prepared and at ease. And like, that was like my mantra, like, no matter what it is, if you don't have time, remember that's what's most important. So I was very relaxed doing the whole cooking and prepping. It was laborious for days, you know, but it was okay. And I didn't really, of course I cared about how people were at the house, but my whole focus was just on having everybody feel comfortable and cared for. And as it turned out, they did, number one. I was at ease, and everybody ended up, like, because I always get so hung up on the food, they absolutely loved the food, and I really didn't even pay that much attention to the food. I just picked four things, made it, they were good, and but that wasn't the expectation. The expectation was, can I show up prepared, at ease, with whatever comes out, if I get two dishes or six dishes. So there, that's it. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you. Don, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation tonight?
I'm not sure how to equate it to something else in my life. I found getting into the moment quite difficult, because I'm the kind of guy who was, you know, paying the check before I've eaten dinner. So concentrating on my breathing and trying to think of something relaxing was difficult for for me because it stressed me out trying to find something that relaxes me. But I think I might get into this, but it's going to take some work.
I hope so. And many, many people say exactly the same thing, that especially the beginning meditation, it's very difficult to not even have other, we talk about other expectations. And if you remember that meditation is for primarily deepening concentration, every time you find that you're caught up in your thinking, it's an opportunity for deepening your concentration. You do that by then focusing on your breath. And even if that lasts for just a split second, it really doesn't matter. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And even if you become frustrated, that's okay. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And eventually, your own conditioned resistance to sitting quietly and being mindful of your breath will simply fall away. But remember that meditation is part of a broader framework, and it's the other factors of the Eightfold Path that support a deepening and much easier meditation practice. So it's not just meditation. And again, I'd say the same thing. Start with short periods of meditation, 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, and if you can do that consistently twice a day, very soon you'll have a well-established meditation practice and experience the same benefit. So, and I hope you continue to join us. And there's also a recording of this and other meditations on the website, too, that you can download and listen to. And there's a bunch of articles and other talks that are supportive of this practice. So I'm glad you joined us tonight. Welcome. Joe, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm good.
I enjoy sitting. I think it's hard. It's probably harder after the first month of doing it than it was when I first started. But I enjoy it. As far as the reading goes, I did it. I did the mechanics of it. I did the memorization, and I read it, and then I took out a highlighter, and I read it again and highlighted what I thought was the things I needed to know. And then once I was able to recall them, I started to think about them during the day. So that, you know, I can't think about it if I don't know it, so I have to know it. So it's kind of where I'm at. It was not very, there wasn't a whole lot of deep thinking. I really don't like myself all that much, so to find out that I'm full of crap was actually good news. That's cool.
That's my takeaway, John. that's the beginning of understanding. You know, I'm full of crap, but at least you got a place to go. It's like that old saying Arnold Patton told me years and years ago. If you're in New York and you want to get to Chicago, but you think you're in Los Angeles, or you think you're full, or you don't know you're full of crap, you can't get anywhere. So good for you. That's a great beginning. Thanks, Joe. Glad you're here. Toph, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. It's been a powerful day hanging out with you.
Yeah.
It's been really good to be connecting with this again, and to be in this group and to hear the language, the Eightfold Path, the specificness of it. So just to keep it simple, it's really good to be here, really good to connect with this, be with you guys tonight. Yeah.
Thank you. So glad you're here. Lorna, good to see you tonight. How are you? How's your study going?
I really don't know if I should say all this, but I had just such an amazing day on Christmas Day. I was at the Sound on Saturday morning, and what's his name then, the white t-shirt?
Luke.
Luke, yes. Luke was talking about his craving and clinging, and habits that he's had over the Christmas period, and I've had my issues with craving and clinging over the Christmas period. I called it, indulgences. And I've had problems with indulgences over sort of like Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, historically. And on Christmas Eve, it was the same mindset. And I could look at what was happening to me and kind of understood it from the teachings that I got from you, John. And I kind of somehow just kind of slept on it. And then I woke up on Christmas morning And I was, and on the Christmas Eve, my mind was like an addict, I think. Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say that because I know addicts are way, 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 way worse. But it was kind of
maybe not.
Almost to that extent that I have.
I didn't hear that last thing you said. I'm sorry.
It was almost to that extent that I have craving and clinging thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on Christmas Eve, and I slept on it. And on Christmas morning, normally I'd have woken up in the same mindset and gone through a Christmas day with a very craving and clinging mind, very unsettled. And actually, the reverse happened. I woke up on Christmas morning. I was very calm. I had no craving and clinging thoughts about any indulgences at all. And by, I don't know what time it was exactly, but it was Christmas morning. You don't really keep an eye on the clock on Christmas morning. But it was about 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning. And I was so calm that I just felt that I got this.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I had enough of the Dharma teachings inside of me to understand all of the situation, all of it, from the craving and clinging, your mind being possessed by craving and clinging, and the whole shebang. And by about 10 o'clock in the morning, as I said, I knew that I wasn't going to get any that day. And I just had a completely different Christmas day than I've had for years and years and years. And you have the phrase, the Buddha, the Dharma,
the three refuges.
Three refuges. What do you have that you fall back into? What's that phrase?
We take refuge in the Buddha, in his teachings of Dharma, and in our Sangha,
yeah,
the supportive Sangha.
That's always just been a phrase to me that you've used. And it's just like when you come to your classes, you have lots of phrases that we can pick up what the meaning is, but that was one I've never really quite understood it. But that's what I was doing. I had absorbed enough of the Buddha teachings to understand myself and it wasn't even a choice that I made. It was just that I was now somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I did feel that I was just in the Buddha teachings, and I had no problem. And there's Luke down there, he talked about it on Saturday. You talked about it a week ago, Michael. I have a mind like that for every 1 or 2 days a year. And if that's what it is to be addict, I feel so sorry that you have a mind that you have.
We're given what we're given.
I know,
take it from here. Well, I appreciate you saying that. And at the same time, like, we all have our
without you being right there. I don't know why you are here or not. You were on the cushion last week. Right here. I don't know why. I really need you, and here you are. Anyway,
so, what a beautiful example of understanding other suffering through understanding your own.
And I just I've not had a Christmas, haven't I? I've always had a lot of clinging and indulged a lot because it's Christmas. That's what we did at home when I was a child. And I've carried on.
Yeah.
And to the point I've made myself feel uncomfortable and things like that. And I just didn't. It was no effort. It was no effort. I could just see the whole picture. And it's probably with Luke in the morning, listening to what Luke said, and my friend here, what he said last week.
That's that third refuge, you know, that our Sangha is so supportive because of the things that we talk about and because we're so well focused within the framework that the Buddha taught. We don't get into a lot of other nonsensical things. We stay focused here. And again, that's why we're so supportive of each other. You also are speaking about the impermanence of what Keith brought up, this thing, this ego personality. You experience it directly, how impermanent, how fleeting it is. The Buddha likened an anatta, that self-referential ego self, is like foam on an ocean. It just vanishes without really doing anything except the work, and it's gone. One day you realize, that's not who I am. I'm something completely different. And that, what you're also describing, is how the Buddha described an awakened, fully mature human being. A mind that is free of clinging and at peace. At peace with what? At peace with itself in relation to the world. So thank you for all that. Paul, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation?
It's really good.
And you're able to maintain the method? And
I've meditated for many years, and my practice recently has gotten back on track. It feels like it's getting back on track.
Yeah, okay.
But historically, it gets off track. And I'll go for periods of time not meditating at all or very limited. And it's very frustrating.
Yeah.
Since I'm starting to get back to it, what I'm noticing is my attachment to doing things and chores, working, raking leaves, whatever you name it. You know, as long as I'm busy, everything's good.
Yeah.
And if I stop being busy, then it doesn't feel so good. Mm-hmm. So when I practice now, I notice that and I realize it's okay to just be there with that feeling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And not make a judgment on it. Just let it be. For instance, I wasn't going to take this week off. I usually never do. And I was getting anxious towards the end of last week. And I talked to a couple of friends about it. As if I had to get permission. And I did kind of get permission. But what I really got was this feedback about, if you want to be more productive, take time off.
Yeah. Good advice.
So that kind of stuck in my head. And what I notice when I do meditate, not doing anything makes me feel more productive because I realize I don't really have to do all these things.
Yep.
You can just, you know, be with the way it is. It's a practice, though. And it's easier said than done.
Yeah, one of the things that usually develops from meditation in the right context, we're deepening our concentration, which means that we're not making foolish choices anymore, and we naturally become more productive, and we naturally have more energy because we're not wasting a lot of mental energy thinking about things we don't need to think about anymore. And the other thing that you mentioned, the difficulty of maintaining a practice, it's very, very difficult to maintain a solitary practice, meaning just do it on your own and just have meditation alone without developing and integrating the Eightfold Path, because it's the other seven factors that support a meditation practice, and it's the concentration that supports the refined mindfulness to develop the Eightfold Path. So it's really one thing. That's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. And also being part of a Sangha. I hope you can continue to join us occasionally. You'll find just what we're doing here so supportive. We're, I've been in this meditation game for many, many, many years. And honestly, I've never come across as well-focused of a Sangha as we have here in little Frenchtown, New Jersey. We're really fortunate to have what's developed. And that's all of you that have brought yourself here and really given yourself to the Sangha. So thank you. And I'm glad you joined us tonight. Bonnie, how are you tonight? How's your practice?
My practice is probably the best it's ever been, I think. But that being said, I said to you earlier, my brain is saying, oh, yeah? And but I'm trying to be just patient, and that's where it's at. Like you say, take a look at where, what the quality of your mind looks like when you're done, and then be at peace with it. And
yep.
Because that's what's coming up for me. And it's been a really busy time, and I got sick, and I knew that it had to do with a lot of how I was dealing with the stress.
Yeah.
I thought I was dealing with it as best I could, but so it's really been good because we've been sitting more at home and talking about stuff. So, but I think the benefit has been that, of course, over the holidays, a lot of visits and stressors and just being able to step back from stuff, seeing it and recognizing it and stepping back from it and not trying to manage it. But, you know, there has to be the recognition to step back from it, which is the same thing when I'm meditating, say, you know, stop, come back to your breath. Oh, stop, come back, go, you know, kind of, well, okay.
Thank you. The Tibetan word for meditation is gom, G-O-M, and what it means is to become familiar with, or become familiar with your mind. And often as our practice starts deepening, it's not that our minds are really going crazy or getting more agitated, it's just that we're recognizing it, we're becoming familiar with it for the first time, or we have a context in which to see it. And it can be off-putting at first, but if you remember, meditation is for deepening concentration. No matter how your mind is during meditation, come back to the sensation of breathing. And then it doesn't matter. And that brings a certain amount of ease to meditation practice when you remember that too. You know, and that it's part of a broader framework. Great discussion. So this week we're going to study the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path, chapter 4 in the book. And that's right view and right intention. And just a little background, just to go over something I talk about all the time. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which states that from ignorance, a very specific ignorance, to 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. And that very specific ignorance is ignorance of the nature of life, Four Noble Truths. And so his very first teaching is the very first time that he taught the Four Noble Truths. It's called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Setting the wheel of truth in motion. And again, everything the Buddha would teach for the next 45 years was in context of that very first teaching. Now, he didn't teach dependent origination until much later in his teaching career, and it's impossible to determine that because the Pali Canon is not written in a chronological order. But my best guess is it's probably a minimum of 3 months, but more likely or probably around 3 or 4 years before he actually taught dependent origination. And so why is that? Because nobody had yet developed a context in which to understand dependent origination. And if you look at how the book is set up and the course, dependent origination is the eighth week. It's not the first thing. And the reason for that is that there's no context yet for understanding dependent origination until we've gotten to that point and understand a couple of other contexts. And that brings us to tonight's talk. The Eightfold Path is right view, right intention, the virtuous factors of right speech, right action, right livelihood, and then the concentration factors of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And using that, the word right, I could just as easily use skillful or appropriate, but right kind of gets right to the point. So by saying that there's such a thing as right view and right intention, etc., implies that there is such a thing as wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, etc. And when the Buddha awakened, he understood that we have a common human problem of conditioned thinking, which means, another word for that is confirmation bias. We're biased towards seeing things in a way that confirms our already held views, no matter how much difficulty those views might bring us. We've already created this ego personality. This is me. These are my views. I'm going to protect them no matter what, and no matter what they bring me. So we can go on maintaining wrong view. And unless we have a vehicle for recognizing wrong view and developing right view, there's no way we can get there. In other words, remember, we're in New York, we want to get to Chicago, but we believe we're in Los Angeles. That's a wrong view. The right view is putting ourselves where we are, in New York, or in this case, in Frenchtown, New Jersey, tonight. So the Buddha recognized this problem, and he gave an eightfold path to overcome the common human problem of conditioned thinking, confirmation bias, and develop right view. And when the Buddha described a fully awakened, fully mature human being experiencing right view, he described it this way. Right view fully understands the First Noble Truth, fully understands stress, fully understands dukkha. Craving and clinging has been abandoned in that view. The cessation of suffering has been experienced. We've actually had that experience, and you just described it, Lorna, so congratulations. And the final aspect of right view is that the path leading to the cessation of suffering has been developed, meaning the Eightfold Path has been fully developed. Along the way, we have levels of right view. And what I mean by that is the initial right view is just the acceptance that maybe I don't know everything there is to know. And maybe there's something in this Four Noble Truths that this guy figured out 2,600 years ago. Let me try to understand this. And that's the beginning of right view. Another word for that would be mundane right view, as opposed to a super mundane or fully developed right view, which is simply an awakened human being. So right view understands stress. It has abandoned craving and clinging. It has experienced the cessation of stress and has fully developed the Eightfold Path, meaning that we've integrated into our lives. And at first, these are a lot of unfamiliar terms. And at first, this can seem almost impossible, but it's only because we're unfamiliar with it. So that's why the Buddha often used this term, ehipasiko, which means come and see for yourself, which tells us that we have to experience this. Initially, as human beings, the first thing we do to learn anything is it's an intellectual understanding. We take it in through somebody telling us or reading about it or hearing about it. But then we have to apply this in our lives. It's not enough, as Joe was saying, it's not enough just to memorize what the teaching is. We have to actually experience that. And that begins with the next factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention. And both of these factors relate directly to the Four Noble Truths. So right view is developing an understanding of the First Noble Truth and developing the entire practice. The Second Noble Truth is that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. And that's individual craving. So right intention then is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. It ties directly into the practice. This isn't something else. It's all part of the Four Noble Truths. And Maura mentioned right intention. Right intention is the framework that we use to maintain our focus within the Eightfold Path. In other words, if we maintain the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, we're developing the entire Eightfold Path as it's meant to be. That gives us our direction and guidance, right intention. So beginning with right view, the initial mundane right view is I don't know everything there is to know about myself in relation to the world, and I think there's something here. So we start developing a meditation practice within that broader framework. And then we start developing right intention. And as our concentration deepens and our mindfulness becomes more refined to hold in the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path, then we can really practice that right intention, meaning that we can recognize craving and clinging. And next week, we'll introduce the virtuous factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. But those of you that have been developing this understand that it is in recognizing our behavior, whether it's wrong or right, skillful or unskillful, that's how we recognize our craving and clinging. And that's the primary reason why the Buddha taught moral and ethical or virtual factors. This is where Buddhism or the Buddhist teachings start touching on religion because of these moral factors. And he taught them in a way it's important for us to be moral and ethical in a general way. But as we develop our understanding of our speech, our thoughts, words, and deeds, that's where we're able to recognize where our craving and clinging is arising. And as we have maintaining our right intention to recognize that, it becomes even more effective and even more powerful as part of our practice. So right view and right intention are recognized as the wisdom factors because they provide the wisdom to continue and maintain the proper framework for developing the entire path. And so you can see the circular nature of the path. We begin with a mundane right view, and as we deepen our concentration and continue to integrate the Eightfold Path into our lives, we develop a super mundane or a fully developed right view. And it all comes back to understanding stress, understanding dukkha, and recognizing our own contributions to that. You know, and the other aspect that should be pointed out, because it relates to right view, when the Buddha described the First Noble Truth, he described dukkha occurs. And then he described what dukkha is. Dukkha is birth, sickness, aging, death, something that as human beings, we are all part of that. We can't escape it. No reason to even try. Not getting what is wanted is part of dukkha. Getting what is not wanted, receiving what is not desired is part of dukkha. And then he concludes, there's some other things that he throws in there in different suttas. And then he concludes that with saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. And the easiest explanation, and we'll talk more about this in week 8 or 9, depending how we split that up, but the easiest explanation of the five clinging aggregates is our own clinging to views, clinging to confused and deluded views or conditioned thinking. So the Buddha is saying that it's your conditioned thinking that is creating this suffering in your life. So again, the whole entire Eightfold Path is in place, designed to recognize and abandon our own conditioned thinking. And that's the introduction to this week's study. So, any questions about that? Okay, good. So we'll read the chapter on right view and right intention, week 4, and we'll discuss that next week, and that'll introduce the week study on the virtuous practice of the Eightfold Path. Right? No questions? Okay, so we'll conclude with metta, the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.